welcome to This Week in Debian, the podcast bringing you the latest interviews and news inside the Debian community, brought to you by frostbitemedia.org, the network bringing you your favorite GNU Linux podcasts.
Saludos y saludos. This is Rick Claudio Montalban, brother of Ricardo. If you are like me, you enjoy the finer things in life, like cars, Corinthian leather, and Linux fests. Join Indiana Linux Fest, one of the finest Linux fests, as they begin their march to freedom. Go to IndianaLinux.org to learn more. That's IndianaLinux.org. Now that is what I call fine Corinthian leather.
Hey, thanks for listening. Before we get into the interview, I want to mention our sponsor, HostGator. They're a hosting company that has shared hosting, VPS hosting, dedicated servers. You can get a shared hosting plan for $5 a month with unlimited bandwidth, unlimited disk space. These guys are awesome. They run their servers on CentOS. This is what all the Frostbite stuff is running on, and I want to thank them for being a sponsor. So if you want to go check out HostGator, go to frostbitemedia.org/HostGator. And sign up for an account and check them out. They're really great. They've been nothing but fantastic to us. So check out frostbitemedia.org/HostGator. Here's the interview. Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us this week. Today we've got a very exciting episode. We are speaking with John Mad Dog Hall. Mad Dog, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
So, Mad Dog, for those who may not know your history, and this first question I ask everyone is, how did you first get involved in free software and or Linux? And I'll leave that up to you of how far and how descriptive you want to get with that story, because I know we could be on that for a while.
Well, I'll try and make it brief. And basically, I've been programming since 1969 when I was a college student. And back in those days, there weren't enough of any one type of computer to really justify creating binary distributions. So most of the software that you got was in source code form. And as a college student, I couldn't afford to pay $100,000 for a compiler, so which is, you know, what you might pay at that point. But I was involved with this organization called DECUS, the Digital Equipment Corporation Uses Society, that had a whole bunch of people who were not programmers. They were scientists, engineers, mathematicians, business people, doctors, lawyers, who wrote software for this new thing called a computer, a relatively new thing. And then they would donate it to the library because they were not professional programmers. They were everything I mentioned before. And they said, well, you know, I don't want to get into the business of writing software. I just I had to write this software for my own use, and maybe somebody else can help me make it better. Or maybe I can help somebody with the software. And, you know, these are a lot of the reasons why people write free software today. Mm. They're not necessarily writing it for somebody else, although you can do that. A lot of times people are writing software because that they have an interest in that, or they need it for their own work. And when they get finished, they say, well, you know, I could try and sell this, but I've already got a job. You know, I'm a systems administrator, or I'm a teacher, or I'm, you know, or I need it for my own business. And so they contribute it back, and other people look at it, help them improve it, help them make it better.
Man, it's like almost 30 years before the open source term was even coined.
Exactly. And what happened was during the 1970s, when people started to mass produce computers, the first microcomputers came out, and there was an operating system called CPM, that was developed as a binary-only distribution. Along came MS-DOS as a binary-only distribution. People started to move in that direction, and so move away from a source code distribution to a binary-only distribution. And this was viewed as being the way to protect your intellectual property. And I know that there'll be people out there that hate that term, but there it is. And it's trade secrets. And I was by that time I was involved with an operating system called Unix. I was working for Bell Laboratories, and I had, I got Unix as source code because I was inside of the telephone company that, made it in Bell Labs. And I was used to using it as source code. And then several times I found bugs inside the system that was blocking me from doing my work. And I would go and get the source code for the thing and fix it, and send a patch back to the people that put it together. And they thanked me for it. We would go to these conferences called USENIX, where everybody would get together from universities and different Bell Labs locations and things like that. And we would talk about Unix systems and improving it. And then one day, this guy shows up and says, gives a nice talk and everything. And people say, "Hey, let's exchange the source code for that." He says, "Well, I'm sorry, but I work for this company called Sun Microsystems. And we're not allowed to distribute the source code, And there was a lot of booing and hissing from the crowd, But then over time, more and more people did that from different companies. And each time there was a little bit less booing and hissing because people got used to it. And after a while, there was no more booing and hissing. People were so used to it that they didn't do it. And so now, there was one person who didn't stand up for that, and actually there's a lot of people, but this one person in particular, Richard Stallman, who went on, and he was a student at MIT at the time, and he said, "I want to see the source code for an operating system. I believe this is the proper way of developing software." And so he started up this project, and he started out with the Emacs editor. And some people could say he could have stopped with Emacs because that's like a whole operating system itself. But he continued on, and he did. It was kind of interesting because instead of trying to write the kernel of an operating system back in those days, back in 1984, he wrote other things that would go on top of other operating systems, on top of other kernels. So the GNU compiler suite, for instance, was poured across a wide range of different operating systems and different architectures, and was very useful to people who were writing code that had to go across all these different systems. Boeing actually went in and standardized on the GNU compilers, even though there were commercial compilers out there that would generate code that would be 10, 15% more efficient.
Now, you mean Boeing airplanes?
Boeing airplanes,
Man,
right.
that goes against the argument where, people now say, commercial entities don't want to deal with free software. There's no one to blame. There's no one to point the finger at. That's like the complete opposite end of the spectrum right there.
Well, the reason that Boeing was doing that was because I don't know how much you know about compiler theory, but there's the standard for the language that says you code the language this way, it does these things. And then there is the semantics of the language. The semantics of the language is how language works. But then there are the side effects of the language. Now, the standard clamps down pretty good on the syntax and semantics, but the side effects of the language and the side effects of the architecture are sometimes so bad that it requires you to put all sorts of different if-defs and stuff in your code, so that you actually have different code that's going on different systems. And by standardizing on the GNU compilers, they had the same syntax and the same semantics, and for a good part of it, the same side effects across all these different architectures and operating systems. And that just saved them a huge amount of money and time, and made their code much more stable and dependable. Now, as far as having a person to blame. What happened there was there was this group of people out in California who said, hey, we'll start a little company going to provide support for these and support these compilers to new architectures or to new operating systems as Boeing needs it.
Okay.
And that little company was called Cygnus.
Okay.
And they were one of the first companies to actually sell support for free software and make money at it. And it actually, Cygnus eventually was purchased by Red Hat.
Oh, okay.
And Michael Tian, I better not say the name because I'll screw it up and they'll be mad at me. But in any case, Cygnus was bought by Red Hat and they continue to do much the same type of work today of supporting the GNU compilers across a wide range of different architectures. So there is that. I mean, companies, it's not so much they want somebody to blame, but they are not in the business of creating free software. Boeing is not in the business of creating compilers. They're in the business of creating airplanes.
Right.
And so they want to specialize on that function, okay? And that's why they go and they would like to have somebody stand behind it.
Yeah.
You know, if you take a look at most warranties on software, they're just ridiculous. I mean, a warranty that you get with Microsoft Windows, for example, doesn't even protect you from your computer bursting into flames if you put Microsoft software on it. I mean, it's just absolutely worthless.
Yeah, I think even in the EULA, it's like, hey, if you're using this for business and you lose all your files, we're not to blame.
Like
it's
exactly.
it's brilliant on their part, you know, because they're forking over your money for it, and they have no nothing to blame for.
Well, there is no lawyer on the face of the earth that would ever allow an operating system like Windows or any other operating system to be liable for damages. It's just too risky.
Yeah.
Okay. And so nobody would ever do that. And if you want that type of protection, you need to go out and buy insurance, not go with a warranty of software. So in any case, so Richard started this up, and he had all of these different things. So there was the compiler suite, there was Emacs, there was a set of utilities and things like that. So by around the time frame of 1991. Besides things like the X Windows system and Sendmail and Bind and a lot of things from the BSD operating systems and stuff, there was this huge amount of software that was available. But the part that was missing was the kernel itself. Now, if Richard had started writing the kernel back in 1984, what he would have ended up with is maybe a great kernel, but there wouldn't have been anything to put on top of it.
Right.
And his kernel would be obsolete because every few years we were developing new thoughts and everything around kernels, new ways of doing stuff. So any kernel that he started to write in 1984 would be obsolete by 1991. You could take a look at, and the hardware was getting cheaper and more powerful. So a kernel that would be of interest to people in 1984 would be of no interest in 1991.
Yeah.
So along comes 1991, and this person at a university in Helsinki had just gotten a brand new 386 computer with an operating system on it that came from a vendor in the far northwest of the United States. And this student realized that this operating system didn't take advantage of the features of the 386 because 386 was the first Intel processor that actually could handle demand-based virtual memory. The 286 and the 186 could do swapping, but that's a really miserable system compared to demand-based virtual memory.
Yeah.
And this student said, hey, I know there's an operating system out there that does this. It's called Unix. But he looked around, and all the Unix systems he could see were either really expensive, and they typically didn't ship the source code. And a lot of that was because still the AT&T source code license was still required at that time.
Okay.
So he decided he was going to write his own kernel, and he started it up. And of course, this later became Linux. And people started joining in and everything. And I was completely oblivious to all this. I was working for DEC and Digital Equipment Corporation in their technical marketing department. And I was still involved with Deekus after all these years. I was still going to Deekus meetings and talk with the users and stuff. I love Deekus. And we would exchange software through the Deekus library. And I had this friend of mine, Kurt Riesler, who was the head of the special interest group for Unix. And Kurt wanted to have this person from Europe come to the United States to talk about this project he was working on that I had not heard anything about. And Kurt kept sending out emails to these little companies, Yggdrasil and Soft Landing Systems and stuff, and saying, please, could you help me fund this guy to come talk about Linux to Deekus members? And they said, well, we don't have the money to do that, but be happy to give you some free CDs to hand out. And Kurt kept copying me on these emails, and I felt sorry for him. So I went to my management and I said, I don't know who this guy is or what he did, but I think, Kurt has some good ideas every once in a while, and I think we should fund this. And so we did. And I met Linus for the first time, saw Linux, realized that this was not a toy operating system. This is not toy kernel. I forget which distribution we were actually using. I can't remember. But when they put it on a PC that I got for Kurt, it was kind of like playing a really nice piano. All the keys were in the proper place, weighted properly. Everything I wanted there was there, and the little PC was very peppy. And I says, wow, this is really cool. And I listened to Linus's two talks and had this bright idea that we might port Linux to the Alpha and then use this as a research tool to engage universities in doing research for very large instruction spaces. It's something I've been interested in a long time, because when I started, an address space was 8 bits. You could do anything you want in 256 bytes of memory. And after that, it was 12 bits, and you could do anything you want in 4,096 bytes of memory. And then it was, so with the VAX and with, the microprocessors today, of course, you had 32 bits. But even that, for doing certain types of programming, is rather restrictive. And what happens when you use 64 bits is you can do interesting things. And if you read volume 3 of Don Kanu's book, Sorting and Searching Techniques, you'll see that, towards the back of the book, he says, well, as we get into 64-bit computers, I'm going to have to go back and rewrite this book, because a lot of the sorting and searching algorithms that are impractical today become practical. And this is the type of stuff I wanted to see universities doing. And of course, this would help to draw the alpha into the universities and get more alphas out there. And the other thing was that, having developed operating systems before, I knew that programmers, being human, would tend to sometimes take shortcuts, and they would rely on things that the architecture of the Intel processor to do things inside the operating system. And this is very dangerous. It's very dangerous for stability, because when the chip changes, then you may have lost track of where you did these little, what I will call, Intelisms throughout the kernel, and all of a sudden something breaks. And so this is one reason why operating systems like Linux are divided into device-independent parts and device-dependent parts, so that you don't have to change the device-dependent parts when you go from architecture to architecture. And you can limit the parts that have to change to very small places that you then have control over. and you know to go through and look at them when you go to a new architecture. So I approached Linus. I said, Linus, have you ever thought about putting it to a 64-bit system or a one that has RISC architecture so that you can make sure you've got all of your intelligence out of the system? And he says, well, I've been trying to do that, but Digital's been giving me Digital in Helsinki, Finland's been having problems in getting a alpha processor for me, so I may have to do the IBM PowerPC instead. Now, it's rumored that I kind of screamed when he said this. I dropped my hurricane drink on the deck of the Natchez riverboat that where we were standing. But I don't remember that. And I do remember going back to Digital and calling a friend of mine by the name of Jim Jackson and saying, Jim, you've never heard of this guy. You don't know what this project is, but I need an alpha system sent to Helsinki, Finland immediately. And it just so happened that Jim had just gotten back one of these systems. It was sitting underneath of his desk, not literally, but close. And he said, well, I have a system. Now, again, this is 1994. Memory was not $10 a gigabyte, particularly alpha memory. And the system that I was asking Jim to send to Linus was worth about $30,000.
Man.
And Jim says, what are you going to pay for? And I says, I'll pay for the shipping. So Jim was laughing about this, but he owed me a lot of favors that I had done for him. And this is a favor that I was asking of him. So he managed to send this off to Helsinki. And that was the system that Linus started as port one. And I helped Linus get documentation and stuff. And for it, and it was, we, and he Linus wanted to finish up version 1.2 of the kernel, make it stable, before he started this project. So I met him in May of 1994. He studied the documentation, everything. We actually started the project around January of 1995, but by fall, by November of 1995, we not only had a complete port, but Red Hat had a distribution based on the alpha.
Man.
And for people who have done ports of operating systems, 9 months a port done by a group of people who hardly ever, if ever, saw each other face to face and only conversed over the net, was incredible.
Yeah, that
Yeah.
sounds
Incredible.
speedily fast.
Yeah. And particularly by people that were not paid to do this and even went out and spent their own money to get Alpha Systems to help with the port.
Wow.
So this is where I really began to feel this feeling of community, this feeling of helping, this feeling of we want to participate. And I started having all these people in my organization say, why are you spending your time with us at Digital? Why are you spending your time with us? I mean, this is crazy. I said, you just don't understand, that this is something that is bigger than you think it is. It's something which is going to happen. And now all of those people work for Red Hat.
So I guess they saw it come to
Yes, they
pass.
did. And people who actually laughed at me aren't laughing anymore.
Yeah, really. They should shake your hand and say thanks for the paycheck. Not that you're giving them their paycheck, but.
Well, unfortunately, that doesn't really happen a lot. So, but there are some people at Red Hat that I have a great deal of respect for, and they didn't laugh that much, and so that I'm very happy that as Digital was sold to Compaq, and then Compaq was sold to Hewlett Packard, that these people went off and got positions in the free software world and are making contributions to it. So I'm
So
very happy with
did the
that.
majority of people from Digital kind of stay in the free software realm because of what you guys were doing with that early port of the Linux kernel?
A lot of them did, particularly the people that were in the Digital Unix group.
Okay.
Because our Digital Unix group was located in Nashua, New Hampshire, right over the line from Massachusetts. And there were a series of engineers who left the project about 1998 or so, and they went to a small company that was working on highly available systems, clustering systems.
Oh, okay.
Fortunately, that company had some financial problems and collapsed, but they then started up the Westford, Massachusetts branch of Red Hat. And these are people like Paul Cormier, who's now the Senior Vice President of Engineering, and Brian Stevens, who's Vice President and Chief Technical Officer of Red Hat, Tim Burke, Larry Wood. I mean, these guys are really stellar, very good engineers, very bright. And Red Hat has the philosophy, the corporate philosophy and culture of moving the code back upstream,
Which is
which is.
fantastic.
And it just makes great business sense. I mean, it really does. And it's stupid for people to create patches and things like that and then not move that stuff back upstream. Because, all they have to do then is as people keep, as the work goes on inside the kernel, they have to keep applying those patches over and over and over again. Bounce up. It's just crazy, So in any case, a lot of them are working for Red Hat, and I see them all the time, and that's great. And then other people, unfortunately for Digital, other they left Digital, but they went. Some of them are still with Hewlett Packard, doing good stuff, and some of them have gone on to other companies in the area. Some of them are free software, and some of them are proprietary. But so that in 1996. I was contacted by a bunch of little companies who had started this organization called Linux International, and they asked if I would take over the leadership of that from somebody named Alan Fetter, who needed to go off and do stuff to earn money because he had two girls in college. And we started Linux International, very small organization with very small companies. And we did things like secure the Linux trademark so that this person was holding it hostage wouldn't be able to, and that people could use it freely. We helped to start the Linux Professional Institute, LPI, which does certification for systems administrators. We actually started two different organizations. One of them was one that linked certification with training and was a for-profit. And then the other one was LPI, which is a nonprofit and separates certification from training. And of the two models, I believe that the second one is the better because it allows somebody to get the training that they need through whatever means they want. And then for a relatively small amount of money, get certified so they can then get a certificate that says they know what they know. And for many people around the world, that's the only way they can afford it. They can't afford to pay $4,000 to take a course to learn this, right? Nor should they have to. I mean, if they've picked it up on their own, if they've learned it by reading books or going out on the net, they should be able to simply be certified and then go on.
Yeah, as long as you pass the test, you should be all set.
And then we started the Free Standards Group with the Linux Standard Base Project. And we felt that was important because we didn't want to see the different distributions diverge. And the goal there, of course, was to make sure that applications that are written for one specific distribution architecture work on another distribution architecture. And those are the three main things that LI did. Plus, we helped a lot of user groups get started. We helped a lot of trade show groups like the Ohio Linux Fest and the Northeast Linux Fest
Yeah,
get
definitely.
going. And we talked to a lot of people about what free software really means and the fact that it's a freedom to change the software. Unfortunately, in this country, people have a hard time understanding freedom. And recently I've started talking about the opposite, slavery instead. So, because people can envision slavery a lot easier than they can envision freedom.
That's true.
And so when you're a slave, when you were a slave, you were told where to go, what to do, who to marry, nothing you had belonged to you, it all belonged to the master, all these things. And so when you were a software slave, you're told when to upgrade, how many machines you can put it on, what you can software, what you can't do with the software. You don't own anything. It all belongs to the producer. You just have the right to use it. You have the right to existence.
That's a really good way of approaching it, definitely.
And you lose control. A slave does not have control over their life. And a software slave does not have control over their software. And as a business person, that means you don't have control over your business. And if there's one thing that business people understand, it's the word control. They want control. They want to be able to know where their business is going and how to do it. So these days, I often talk about, control and the control that free software gives you in your business or in your education.
That's definitely a good way to approach it. I think the English language too has a little bit of fault, even with the word free, because everyone just associates free cost. Even if you say, I think other languages have a better, like that, like Libre is a much more powerful word for, freedom. And so this part of the English language is a problem too, I think.
Well, and I got into this slavery idea because of Software Libre and Software Livre in Portuguese. Started thinking about it and saying, we're really, unfortunately also in the United States, the word slavery has, I mean, slavery is a very horrible thing. And I don't mean to belittle anything that African Americans have gone through or any of the other people who have ever been held in slavery. I don't mean to belittle that by any means. In fact, the opposite. I want to show how horrible it is and that people shouldn't be doing it, even when it relates to software. So that's how I got into it. And I make my money these days by being a consultant. I do consulting. And I still go around the world. I've been to over 100 countries in the world, most of them more than one time, talking about free software and Linux and I have some successes I could point to, and I'm very happy about them. And I meet lots of young people.
Well, speaking of traveling the world, I'd like to talk to you about Project Kawa as a new project that you're starting to work on here. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what your vision is with this?
A few years ago, I was doing some consulting work for a small company that was talking about environmentally friendly computing, and they wanted to use thin clients and server systems to help cut down on the amount of electrical utilization. So I started working with them, and eventually they kind of drifted off to the side, but I still continued to think about this a lot. And I was going down to Brazil. Now, when most people think of Brazil and Latin America, particularly Brazil, they might think of the Amazon rainforest. They think about, the Amazon River and Parana. They think about Carnival, all this stuff. But what they don't think about is the fact that São Paulo is the second largest city on the face of the earth. And depending upon how you count people, anywhere between 19 and 29 million people live in this very large area. They have very tall apartment buildings. They have very tall office buildings, highly dense area, extremely dense. They don't think about the fact that 86% of the people of Brazil live in an urban environment.
Wow, that's a lot.
Only 16% live in a rural environment. So it's very dense, and in the cities, you go to Manhattan, and yes, you have brownstones and you have tall skyscrapers and tall apartment buildings, but you have a lot of houses that even have backyards, right? Well, in Brazil, it's incredibly dense. It's probably at least 25% more dense in people living in a certain area. So I started looking at that, and of course the other thing that they have a lot of in Brazil is slums, and they call them favelas, where they have very poor people living right next to very rich people. And I says, you know, if we could just bridge that gap, if we could, you know, somehow bring the internet into there, then we can give people very inexpensive internet devices. They could access the internet. They could store their data back on server systems, kind of like in a cloud. And they could have access to the information they need for training and to start businesses and things like that at a very low cost, or maybe even paid for by advertising. So I started thinking more about this, and then I started thinking about creating actual jobs and say, how could I create jobs? Because I'd have all these people come up to me at these events, free software events, and they'd say, Mad Dog, I want to make money with free software. How do I do that? So I said, well, okay, in the basement of these apartment houses or these office buildings, let's put a highly available server. And then in all the desktops and in all the apartments of these buildings, let's put thin clients and hook them together with really high speed networking, either fiber or 10 gigabit per second Ethernet. If it's wired Ethernet, we can do power over Ethernet to the thin client so that it doesn't have to have a separate power supply. That keeps the voltage down to a certain voltage so that you don't have to keep taking it up and down and up and down, which is highly efficient. It keeps the uninterruptible power supply down by the server, so it's, you know, and you can have a generator down there, so in case the electricity goes off for a longer period of time, the generator can start up and provide actual power to keep things going. It keeps all of the heat in one place. Now, in Brazil, it's a very it tends to be a warm place. Their country goes north to south, whereas the United States goes east to west, and a lot of it is wrapped around the equator. So, you know, and they don't have a lot of air conditioning. So their temperate climate in their apartments can easily get to be 35 degrees Celsius.
Man.
And so I said, well, okay, you know, if you then put, you know, a 300 watt electric heater, which we call a PC, or a 500 watt electric heater, which we call a PC, in the apartment, it's generating 500 watts of heat.
Right.
And that's extra. But if you put all the processing power down in the basement, then what you do is you can water cool that and use that water, the wastewater, the heated water, to preheat water that goes into the hot water system. Or you preheat the water that goes into a swimming pool. So instead of using extra power to heat the swimming pool, you're using the wastewater, the waste heat from the cool, from the computing systems. And you can, and if the computing power is in a reasonably designed server, you can turn off cores, you can turn off memory, you can spin down disk, you can save a lot of power. And then up on the person's desk, they have a 10 watt or less thin client that they can leave on all the time. It's only 10 watts. And if you leave a computer on all the time, then it's useful. But if you turn a computer off, it's useless. So if you're able to leave your desktop on all the time because it's only drawing 10 watts, there's no disk in it, there's no fan, it's absolutely quiet, has a very long lifetime, then that thing can become your alarm clock, your calendar, your telephone. It can receive a telephone call. You know, if you turn off your PC, you can't receive a telephone call on Skype. If you leave it on, you can. So it could be your security system. It could be controlling different security cameras. If anything moves, it can send you an alert. If you turn off your computer, you can't do that. So all these things that if you leave your computer on, you can do. And so I started thinking about all this stuff, and I says, well, you know, this would be a great job for somebody. And not only that, but when somebody has a question about how to use their software, here's somebody that's very local. It's in their building. They don't have to go and look for somebody, right? So, I mean, today, when I got started in computing 40 years ago, computers were extremely expensive, $2.5 million to just to start.
Yeah.
And if you had a problem with your computer, you'd ask the person who sits next to you, who also had a master's degree or PhD in computer science. If you couldn't figure it out, you talk to the person to the left of you who had a master's degree or PhD in computer science. And, eventually you figured it out. But today, what happens if you have a problem with your computer, you pick up the phone, you go boop, 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 and you get this person, or you get this voice that says, please press button number one for sales and button number two for support. And you press two, boop, boop, and then you get music, music, music. And then after about 15 or 20 minutes of music, you get disconnected.
Seriously.
And so if you do a quick calculation, you say that there's 1.25 billion desktop computers in the world, and the average person spends maybe 15 minutes a day either installing software or fixing viruses or getting rid of spam or, all these things, then as a world economy, we're losing about $6.5 billion a day
Man.
because our software doesn't work the way it should, and we can't get the help to make it work the way it should. And if you are a manager of people who are knowledge people, they're all working with computers, this is like you have 300 people reporting to you, and nine people just basically didn't show up for work.
Yeah.
They weren't taking vacation, they weren't sick. Nothing like that. They just said, oh, not coming to work today. Goodbye. As a manager, you'd be infuriated about this. But because this is all done 5 minutes at a time or 15 minutes at a time, we don't really see it. So my idea is you put somebody in there, they take care of the spam, they take care of installing new software, they take care of, and if somebody has a question, says, gee, I can't quite get this to work, then they could find this person and sit down with them and, see how it works. And then they go back and then they're perfectly happy again.
And
They're doing their work.
with it being a centralized, unit, if there's the one mega server or whatever, then that person only has to maintain that one computer, and then in turn, the entire building is maintained.
Exactly. And now a lot of people say, well, isn't this like the cloud? And, to a certain extent it is, but the cloud has some problems that nobody seems to be addressing. And that's the fact that, the cloud is depending on you have a very thin client and you are communicating with the cloud through either wireless or wired environment, but you're using DSL or you're using a cable, which it's 1 megabit per second, maybe 10 megabits per second, and there's latencies there. Or it's wireless and you're in New York City and you can't make a telephone call or you can't download something from your AT&T network because everybody else is downloading porn. And you're cut off from the type of communication. So there's this communication bandwidth issue that I think we've only seen the very tip of the iceberg. And what I want to do is make sure that every thin client is hardwired to the server and then work with the telephone companies and the cable companies to bring in a huge amount of bandwidth to the server. To bring in, 300 megabits a second, a gigabit per second, 10 gigabits per second to the server, and then distribute that to, say, 300 thin clients. So that if you're the only thin client who's actually accessing the internet at that point,
You're
you've
gonna have some
got
awesome
all
speed.
you do. And if by the most remote chance everybody is actually accessing the internet at exactly the same time, you're still not getting any worse performance than you would than if you called up the telephone company yourself
Right.
and got a single line. And from the telephone company's standpoint or the cable company's standpoint, this is like having a large PBX in the building. you know, where they don't manage the end user telephones of the PBX. That's done by somebody else. They just bring in the communications lines. And so they save money on cost of sales, and they save money on support, because now they're only talking to one person who is trained and certified and bonded and licensed, and they don't have to start by asking, "Is your mouse plugged in? Did you turn it on? When was the last time you rebooted it?" You know, when this person calls, they know they have a problem, and they work with it.
And I guess too, if they had like one pipe going into the building, and if there's 50 people in the building, the owner of the building, the landlord or whatever, could just add, $3 a month to their rent or whatever for everyone just to pay for that internet connection, whatever it would be, and then it'd be a lot cheaper for everyone in the building.
We feel with Project Kawa that we can give equal and much better service to people for less money than they're paying right now for these individual things that they purchase, because of all these inefficiencies that I've talked about, the cost of sales, the support issues, the fact that the telephone company, every time they bring a new line into the building, they have to run that line all the way up, you know. And so, you know, what I'm saying is, wire the whole building one time, put in so much fiber and so much internet or Ethernet that, for any possible conceivable future, it's been wired. And then the telephone company only has to worry about bringing the wires and the cables to the basement of the building. They don't have to worry about sending it all the way through. So this, I started putting all this stuff together. I said, "Well, how are you going to finance this, right? I mean, because this is a huge thing." And that's why I think I had my most brilliant thought, is that because each one of these buildings would be able to be a separate business, then these systems administrator entrepreneurs, we call them, could go to the bank and get a commercial loan to buy the equipment, to pay for the installation of the wiring through the building, to get it going, and then pay that back over time, so that the bank sees this constant money flowing in and out, money they lend out on a commercial loan, just like any business, or buying a car or buying a house, and eventually get it paid back, and then they can reloan that money out again to somebody else to start another business. And so this is a completely private sector thing. We're not, no money coming from the government. It's something that, there'll be a lot of people who would make money on it. That's fine. This is Project Kawa, and there's some little offshoots to it. We would like to see the thin client designed at the University of São Paulo, as an example, and then licensed out at a very low price to companies that want to manufacture it. And we feel that this would give the best price for the unit, and then the companies can compete on things like support and manufacturing quality and things like that. And so there's a lot to it, but it's a project. I've talked about this project now for the last 2 years at various conferences. And this year, I've actually started talking with some of the telephone companies and the government about this. So they're very enthusiastic, but we still haven't quite gotten over the hump of getting it started yet. So I hope that in the next 3 or 4 months, we will come up with a magic formula which will generate some money so that we can create the initial code base, and then start Project Kawa going, so that people actually can go to the server, find the code, find the documentation, find the marketing materials. All this stuff will be published absolutely free of cost to anybody who wants to get it. And they'll be able, without having to ask anybody's permission, they'll be able to become a Kawa entrepreneur. Now, we do want the government to work in formulating businesses to license these people, because they are going to be supplying telephony services, they are going to be supplying TV services in effect. And so we want them to be licensed. We want them to be certified. But that's the only requirement. They don't have to kowtow or bend or genuflect to any company to do that. That should be, getting certification should be a mechanical thing that if they have the knowledge, they get certified and they get licensed.
So then would the, so I'd imagine for the first few initial, once this takes off, the first few initial setups, I'd imagine you and the Project Cala team, whatever, would have to be down there and kind of overseeing stuff and showing them the ropes then.
Absolutely, and we want to have pilots in this. So there's two ways of the pilots working. The first pilot is to what we call a vertical market, and we've identified a couple different vertical markets. One of them is home automation, so that you go into your apartment, and as you walk in, the lights come on. It knew you were coming home, so it turned up the heat in your apartment so that it was warm when you came in instead of being cold. The security cameras are de-energized because you're you, and all these things. I mean, that type of home automation, but also home theater, IPTV, IP radio, distance learning capabilities. All these types of things would be there, and the little thin client would also be a wireless mesh repeater. So it would replace a lot of the devices that you have in your house, which are doing things and sucking up electricity, with this one unit that is now programmable, and you can do a whole range of things.
Yeah, now each apartment doesn't need a modem and a router and this and that. There's like three or four devices right away that they don't have plugged in anymore.
Exactly. So that's one marketplace. Another good marketplace is what we call hospitality. Hotels, and in Brazil, again, there's a lot of very small hotels. They call them pousadas, and they would like to have the same services that large hotels have. They would like to have, TV in the room, internet in the room. They'd like to have people be able to order pizzas and stuff like that, and all these different things, but they can't afford it. And they also can't afford to have decent ERP systems for taking things like reservations and stuff like that. So an entrepreneur could go, and if there's two or three pousadas on the same street in a little area, they could manage all three of them and sell enough thin clients and everything to allow these people to have good services. And the pousadas would pay them. So we want to have a pilot for each one of these vertical markets to make sure that the systems administrator entrepreneurs can handle that market, to make sure that the people that are buying the services have everything they need. And then as we finish the pilot, we publish everything out on the server again, so that people can say, "Oh yeah, I'd like that. I don't like the home automation thing, but I really like that one." And it can go and become that type of entrepreneur. They can take the marketing materials that show the hotels what they're doing, and they can take it to a little hotel and say, "This is the services I could provide for you if you agree to buy them." And once they get two or three pousadas, they take that information to a bank. They show it to the bank. The bank looks at it all and says, "Yep, okay, we're familiar with this project. We know what's happening. You've done your homework. Here's the money. Buy the equipment, install it, get it going." And then the pousadas will pay you back. We'll pay you, and then you pay us back. So we do it. And then the second reason we want to do a pilot is we want to do all of this in Brazil first. There's a huge free software movement in Brazil. It's very easy to find people that are doing free software, and it'd be easy to start this up in Brazil. But then we want to be able to take this to the other Latin American countries like Argentina, Uruguay, Chile,
Venezuela and
Peru,
stuff.
Venezuela. I especially want to do Venezuela, and then Mexico, you know. And again, because all these places have the same economic and social types of things. You know, when you're in the city, it's extremely dense. And they're, you know, and a good systems administrator would start off at about $1,000 a month. And, you know, after they were very senior, they might be able to make $2,000 a month. I can actually start one of these entrepreneurs at $2,000 a month. And then if, you know, I figured that they may have to only spend about 10 or 15 hours a week doing this job, maintaining the
Yeah,
system
really.
that's going. Then the rest of the time they can be doing website development. They can be doing programming jobs for their customers. They can be giving classes to help allow the customers to use their systems better. They can be finding out about new free software to install in these people's systems. So all of this work, they might even be able to double the 2,000 to make $4,000 a month. And that's an extremely good salary in Brazil.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, we want to be able to pilot each vertical market, and then we want to make sure that what we do in Brazil also plays out in Argentina or Uruguay. And then if it doesn't, we do a pilot in those countries and then we tweak it to see if it actually does work or not. Once it's working and we're sure of that, then we publish everything and anybody can go in, pull up the information and start their entrepreneurship.
Man, that could definitely make a difference.
Now whenever you talk about a project, there's one thing you could do. You could paint the extremes of the project. So there's 192 million people in Brazil. 86% of them live in an urban environment. That means 184 million people are living in an urban environment. If you were to say that you were going to have one thin client at home and one thin client at school, or one thin client at home and one thin client at work, or one thin client at home, you know, then you double the number of thin clients. So we're up to 360,000, 360 million thin clients. And then point of sale terminals are another use of thin clients. So you toss in about another 90 million of those. So what we're really talking about is about 450 million thin clients. And we're targeting at most 300 thin clients per server. Because we don't want to put any more thin clients than that on a server. And we don't want any more thin clients than that for an entrepreneur. Because if an entrepreneur is supporting 27,000 people, they can't give the independent, you know, we go away from the point of giving better service. So if you say 300 thin clients per entrepreneur, this basically means we need about 2 million entrepreneurs in Brazil alone, and probably another 2 million throughout the rest of Latin America. So that'd be 4 million new high-tech jobs, good paying high-tech jobs that we'd be creating.
Man.
And I don't know that Project Cowboy would work in North America. The economics of systems administrators are different. The densities are different. I mean, it's just not going to work in Kansas. You know, it's not going to work in the plains of Oklahoma.
Well,
It's not.
Comcast would probably kill you with their whole bandwidth cap thing if you're trying to, if you could only hit 250 gigs a month in one building, you'd probably blow through that in like a week.
Well, I mean, again, you work with these companies, I mean, to straighten out these things. And I worked for the telephone company for a long time. I know why some of these things are being put into place. And I believe there's other ways of getting around it. So you work with these companies to fix the problem and in a way that, you know, is usable by everybody. I mean, you know, Comcast should simply say to you, "Hey, use all the bandwidth you want. You know, we're just going to charge you for how much data you pulled out.
Yeah.
So if they put it that way, then everybody say, oh, yeah, great, no problem. Now, the problem with that is that, you know, Comcast has to forecast that. Comcast has to put that into place.
Mm.
And, you know, that's a very expensive thing. And if now they come back and they say, okay, you have unlimited data, but we have to make sure we can support, you know, terabits of information, then nobody might be able to afford even the very basic internet service. You know, my mom and pop, they wouldn't be able to afford their 1 to 2 megabits a second because they're helping to support somebody who's pulling down a terabit a second.
Mm.
So these are the types of things you help people walk through. And I think that, you know, we have some solutions for Project Kawa that I'm talking with some of the telephone companies about that would help with that.
Is the infrastructure down there mostly like DSL? There's not like cable companies providing internet, are there?
No, there are cable companies. They're doing that, and there's quite a bit of DSL. Telefonica is the telephone company doing DSL. But they're still trying to, you know, bring in. They're still a little bit behind the United States. You know, and the United States, quite frankly, is behind some places like Japan and South Korea and China in providing high-speed internet.
Yeah, are we ranked like 12th or 15th or something like that for speed, like in the world?
Yeah, and I really don't want to go into this on this because I just go on for hours, and then I would just get all pissed off. And but in any case, and part of that is just because where I live, right? So, but in any case, this is Project Kawa. And the last thing I want to talk about is that we want to be able to create a wireless internet bubble that would be free as in freedom and free as in beer.
Mm.
And the way to do that is following the model that was done by FON, F-O-N, and also people like British Telecom, where I give up a little bit of my wireless internet to people who need it when they're in my area, and then when I travel outside of my area, I get free wireless internet.
Okay. So how does that work?
Well, remember that each one of the thin clients is hardwired to the server with a 10 gigabit line.
Okay.
Each one of the thin clients is also a wireless mesh repeater.
Mm.
So if somebody's walking past my apartment house, or they're walking past my business, or they're walking past, you know, my school, these little thin clients are acting as a wireless mesh node.
Hmm, okay.
They can connect to that, and they'll get 1 to 2 megabits a second absolutely for free without having to sign any terms and conditions, without having to, you know, type in any password, secret super password, because this is all going to be in a virtualized LAN running on top of a virtualized operating system on this little thin client.
Mm.
So you're not going to be sharing my network. You're going to be using a completely virtualized network, which is separate from everything else. And that's what you're going to be connecting to. So there's no terms and conditions for you to agree to. You know, it's just struck a big wire that went across the entire planet. And all you're doing is attaching to that wire.
Yeah, that'd be pretty cool to just kind of be walking by a building and be like, oh, you know, I need to check my email. You can just sit down at the bench or whatever and pop open your laptop or you use your phone or whatever. And if there's no like 3G connection or whatever, and just tap in and move on your merry way.
Exactly. And it goes with this thing that says, I'm going to give you 1 to 2 megabits a second, you know, and then when I go over to your place, I've left my little, you know, my little bubble, I go over to your bubble, you give me 1 to 2 megabits a second from, you know, from your wired network. And what this does is, you know, I keep using the term wireless mesh, but this isn't really a wireless mesh. It's, you know, hopefully you only have one hop from your wireless device into this network, and then once it's in the network, we can do quality of service routing and quality of service work on it to cut down on the latencies and things like that, the bouncing.
Okay.
So that you've got a low latency, high speed thing. And I say 1 to 2 megabits a second, it could be 10 megabits a second.
Yeah,
Because if you
again, it
have
would
a
depend on who's using their computer inside the apartment at that time.
Yeah, but remember, they've got a 10 gigabit per second connection between their thin client and the server. And the server could well have 100 megabit or 200 megabits or 300 megabits a second connection to the internet.
Man.
So somebody walking past with, even 5 Wi-Fi devices using 10 megabits a second, I really don't care. I really don't. And you can do all sorts of things. I was thinking about this morning, somebody might say, well, what happens if somebody just camps outside of my building continuously using my wireless? Hey, you could work out a policy that says after, 2 hours of sucking down 10 megabits a second, you're throttled back to 2 megabits a second, or you have to disconnect for a certain period of time before you connect again. But the point is, you don't have to sign an agreement. You don't have to sign, put in a super secret password. You just flip open the device and it connects.
Yeah.
And I believe that's what most people want, when they're traveling along, if they're driving along in their car, if they're walking along the street, they don't have to look for the Wi-Fi here sign. They don't have to go in and buy a hamburger. They just want to flip open a device and use it. And when I talk about this, I always end up with, and this is the way that God intended the internet to be used.
With I'd imagine the telcos would probably like this approach better, because now instead of sending 50 little pipes into a building, they're gonna send like one monster one, and all they have to worry about is the one monster pipe, and then after that it's not, not that it's not their problem, but they just have to concentrate on the one giant feed going into the building instead of 50 little ones.
Absolutely. And so I was talking to one of the chief researchers for Telefonica down in Brazil on this last trip. And I was talking about bringing fiber to the home. And he goes, oh, he says, we just can't afford to bring fiber to the home. I says, really? Why not? Oh, well, we did a study. It was going to cost $1,500 to bring fiber to the home. I looked at him and says, a lot of that cost is probably pulling the cable, not the actual cable itself. Oh yeah. It's pulling. He says we could bring in all sorts of capacity, but pulling the cable is really expensive. I said, you mean to tell me that you're stopping me from having really high speed internet because of a measly $1,500 that I'm going to be able to spread over the lifetime of my house? That by increasing the price of my house by $1,500, I'd be able to have, 200 megabits of internet coming into my house every second. Is that telling me? And the guy looked at me strange. He goes, oh my God, I never thought of it like that. They're worried about where they get the money to make this investment and everything. What Project Kawa does is it takes that worry away from them. It's the people who will now own, who would not be paying that $1,500 from the loans from the banks. The telephone company, the way they look at it is, I hook up to this building, I immediately have 300 customers to utilize my pipe.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you're only running that one pipe. You're not running, 150, so.
And so they said, well, what about, we lose the contact with the customer. I says, no. What you're actually gaining is an unpaid, commissioned only salesperson to help you sell the services that you want to sell to the end user customer to the 300 people in that building. That's what you're getting. And somebody who understands, because they've been technically trained, they understand what the service is, they understand what it can do. And now they can go and help to demonstrate it and sell it. And when I started to approach them like that, then all of a sudden they said, yes, now we begin to understand.
Yeah, and instead of actually losing contact with their customers, they're gaining contact with one very specific customer who they'll know on a name-to-name basis. And if he's having problem, the administrator of the building, they have their one specific customer that they always deal with, and it'll be a lot
Exactly.
easier keeping track of stuff with just one guy calling in than 300
They'll
random
have
people.
exactly. They'll have 2 million representatives to represent their services and stuff to their end user customers.
Yeah, exactly. That's brilliant.
So in any case, I started talking with them about 2 weeks ago, and I sent off more information about it and stuff. So one of the things I'm going to be doing today is making contact with them again and saying, have you looked at this? Do you understand this? Do you have any questions? So, and we've also figured that once we get the initial funding to get Project Kawa started, it would take about 1 year for us to pull together all the software to run the pilots and to actually get to the point where we could just turn the switch and allow the entrepreneurs to start up and starting this thing going.
Man, that's an awesome project. I'm definitely looking forward to see what goes down with that.
And the other thing about this is because there's no new hardware that has to be created. All of the software, as far as we can tell, actually exists, and all we have to do is integrate it.
Yeah.
The server systems are off-the-shelf standard server systems from companies like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, or even smaller companies in Brazil like Positivo, stuff like that. I mean, there's really nothing that slows this down. The One Laptop per Child project, which I really admire what Negroponte did and everything, but it was held back because you needed to develop the laptop.
Yeah.
And that was a throttling thing for it. These thin clients basically already exist. Either the Atom processor or an ARM processor or a AMD processor. I mean, USB 3.0 already exists. And so it's just a matter of a manufacturing company manufacturing these in large enough quantities to meet the demand. And the free software, that exists.
Right.
And then what we want to do is we want to do training utilizing the internet. And for the people that don't have a good internet connection, we'll put the training materials onto a DVD and make it available either free or at a minimal cost, 1 to 2 bucks.
Yeah, just to ship it out.
Yep. And then, and then people can put that, you could even put together an entire Project Kawa system using virtualization on your PC. So you could
Man.
have one virtualized machine being the server and other virtualized machines being the thin clients. You could set up the networking. You could practice with it. You could see how it's going to work. And, so that the training materials on this are minimal.
That's amazing. Well, Mad Dog, I appreciate your time, and is there anything else that you wanted to cover? Oh, well, there's one thing I want to mention that Mad Dog has graciously is going to contribute to the Northeast Linux Fest. He's going to be speaking there, so I appreciate him offering his time for that. And so anyone that's planning on going to the Northeast Linux Fest, Mad Dog's going to be there speaking. So if you want to hear some more awesome insights in free software and learn more, he's a fountain of knowledge. So come on down, watch Mad Dog, hear Mad Dog, watch Mad Dog, and you can hang out with him at the after the party and
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yes, at Julian's.
Yeah.
We did a little bit of hanging out last night. It was fun.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
Definitely.
okay. Well, thank you very much for the time to talk and to talk about Project Cal. I appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. I think that's an awesome project. What if people want to help in any way, shape, or form, where should they go?
Well, we have a website now, www.projectcaua. projectcaua.org. Kawa is the Tupian, Brazilian Tupian Indian word for eagle.
Okay.
And we chose the eagle as our symbol because the eagle is a very large bird. In fact, Brazil has the largest eagle in the world, and it's a very strong bird. It's very free, and with the Project Kawa emblem is the eagle flying against the sun, done in a stylized manner of the Indians. And the other reason why we chose that title is that I have a Brazilian godson whose name is Kawa,
Oh,
and right
nice.
now he's 4 years old, and someday I want to be able to say to him, if you would like to have a good job that's technical and working with free software, then maybe you could become a Kawa entrepreneur and do that job.
Man, that's awesome.
So that's where you can do it. And if you're interested, look under downloads and documentation. There's a 3-page letter there in English, another one that's 5 pages in English and Portuguese, which describes the basic functionality and features of Kawa. And then there is a 37-page description in much more detail about the software and the hardware and how it works and how it goes together and how we're going to do the training and things like that and our plans for implementation. Unfortunately, there isn't a lot of software on the site that you would recognize as being, quote, Project Kawa. And the reason for that is that we don't anticipate that we're going to be doing a lot of software. We're going to basically, our current plans are to use a standard distribution that already exists, and then to actually, in effect, automatically install the components and that would go into making up Project Kawa. So that we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We don't want to create another distribution. That is not what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is make it easier to be a systems administrator for these particular vertical markets. So we want to automate that process.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see this. I think that's quite the task, but I think it can be done. So, with the right cooperation, which it sounds like you're getting, this I think this could definitely get off the ground.
All right. Well, nice talking with you, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks, Mad Dog, for
And
your time. I appreciate it.
yeah, and I want to see all these people that are listening to this come to the Northeast Linux Fest. I think you're doing a great job, and it's very exciting. And this is the first year, but hopefully it'll go on for many more years.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Right.
Right, thanks,
Take
Mad
care.
Dog. Bye. Thank you for listening to This Week in Debian. If you know someone or you yourself are in the Debian community, please get a hold of us. We can interview you. If you'd like to get a hold of us, our email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Again, that email address is feedback@frostbitemedia.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.